could the democracies be made to realize the danger which we scientists saw in our oscilloscopes. Our only chance was getting Professor Einstein to see Roosevelt.
In the fall of 1939, Professor Albert Einstein wrote the following letter to the President of the United States.
Dear President Roosevelt, some recent work by A. Fermi and L. Tillard leads me to expect that uranium may be turned into a new and important source of energy in the immediate future. This new phenomenon would also lead to the construction of bombs, and it is conceivable, though much less certain, that extremely powerful bombs of a new type may thus be constructed. I understand that Germany has actually stopped the sale of uranium from the Czechoslovakian mines that she has taken over.
And a short time later, the Navy transferred the sum of $6,000 to our scientists.
Less than 1 month later, Hitler sent his blitzkrieg against Europe, then the collapse of France, and the miracle that was Dunkirk and Britain standing alone. And at long last, Mr. Churchill.
I speak to you for the first time as Prime Minister in a solemn hour for the life of our country, of our empire, of our allies, and above all, of the cause of freedom. Let us therefore brace ourselves to our duty, and so bear ourselves that if the British Empire and its Commonwealth last for 1,000 years, men will still say, this was their finest hour.
And one of Mr. Churchill's first decisions as Prime Minister had to do with the atomic energy program. Britain agreed to send its best scientists to the United States. Our intelligence department told us that the German program was well underway. Late in 1941, our top scientists called a council of war. Could a bomb be built in time? Secretary of War Henry Stimson, who helped to make the final decision, along with FDR and General Marshall, called it
a gamble, but as necessary in war, a calculated risk. We decided to go ahead.
Our chips were finally in the pot, 2 billion of them. The date was December 6th.
December 7th, 1941, a date which will live in infamy. The United States of America was suddenly and deliberately attacked by naval and air forces of the Empire of Japan.
I remember that day, all right. But Bill, I still don't see what we had to gamble on. We still didn't know if we could get that one split atom to start that chain reaction you were talking about.
Exactly. So immediately, 3 great research centers were set up. One at Columbia, one at Chicago, and one at California. All were vital, but I guess the Chicago mission was the most dramatic.
Arthur Compton, I was at Chicago with Fermi and Tillard. Our job was to build a pile of uranium and see if we could get that chain reaction going. Actually, you might say, it was an atomic bomb in miniature.
My name is Rentler, Director of Research, Westinghouse. One day, early in 1942, Dr. Compton called me and asked me how soon we could deliver 3 tons of pure uranium to him. We had been experimenting slightly with uranium and had assembled the enormous amount of a few grams by then, about as much as 3 dimes. But Dr. Compton said that it was vital to the war, and so we went to work. In November 42, I was able to wire Compton and say that the 3 tons of pure uranium were on their way to Stagg Field.
Stagg Field? Isn't that where the University of Chicago used to lose all its football games?
That's right. But at Stagg Field, in November of 1942, They were lining up for the most exciting game ever played in any stadium. Beneath the stands of Stagg Field, there were squash courts. A cordon of guards was thrown around the entrance. Even the president of the university was not allowed in, and the most scientific bricklayers in history went to work.
We had but one aim at Stagg Field. We were after that chain reaction. We knew now that uranium was fissionable. We knew that if you put enough of it together, sufficient neutrons would begin bombarding sufficient atoms and forcing out other neutrons, which in turn would go into more atoms. The problem was how much pure uranium did you have to put side by side and on top of itself to get that pile going and still not blow yourself up.
It's a nest for their star about to be born. They built a timber framework resting on the lined squash court. And this, they were going to erect a uranium pile in the shape of a cake.
I was one of the bricklayers. Actually, we couldn't lay the uranium one by one beside each other, or the neutrons would have shot out so quickly that we'd have lost them. So we put each piece of pure uranium in a graphite brick to slow down the action. And slowly we built our pile, brick by brick. 6 tons in all, but ounces at a time.
My job was safety. What we were doing had never been done before. We thought we knew what we were doing, but we also knew that we might accidentally start a premature chain reaction that would in an instant vaporize all the uranium and graphite, blow us sky high, and start a Chicago fire worse than the one Mrs. O'Leary's cow started. So we took precautions. We built 10 slots through the pile, and into these slots we put rods of boron and cadmium. Now, don't let those words scare you. Boron and cadmium are simply metal rods. But for some reason, when neutrons strike them, they devour the neutrons, like cannibals. As long as we had those boron and cadmium rods in there, we were safe. They would act as fire dampers, firewalls, you might say.
Well, with these rods in, how could they get the atomic fire going?
Good point, Bob. They couldn't. But after the pile got near the estimated correct size, Dr. Fermi could give the signal slowly to withdraw the rod. Open the damper, as we say.
My name is Zinn. I was one of those with his eyes glued on the neutron counters. The census takers, you might say, that told us how many neutrons were being born and how many were dying. On the 23rd day, our counters showed that we were making a lot of neutrons, but just as many were dying. When our instruments registered 1,600, it would mean that we were creating more than we were losing. We'd be in. Remember that figure, 1,600, and we'd be in.
Around midnight of the 23rd day, one of the coldest nights of that cold Chicago winter, a bunch of weary bricklayers noticed a distinct change in the tempo.
The pile was only 3/4 complete, but with every brick, the speed of the neutron counter seemed to increase.
The next day was December 2nd. By noon, an air of tremendous expectancy and excitement had permeated every inch of the room. There they stood around their baby. Compton, Fermi, Gillard, Zinn, Anderson, and all the others. The counters were increasing their tempo. Within an hour, their first self-sustaining atom chain reaction in the history of man might be a reality. And then, Fermi, the imperturbable, looked up from his instrument and said,
"All right, boys, let's go to lunch."
After the most preoccupied lunch in history, the bricklaying continued.
1350.
The last egg was gently nestled into place.
1370.
1385. 1400.
Intently, we stood watching. Fermi, like a captain docking a great ship, maneuvered the cadmium rods into final position.
Very slowly now, pull out the rods. 1425. 1450. Zip them out a little more.
On Fermi's signals, we evenly withdrew our fire dampers.
Keep going. Zip them out slowly. 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 1500. 1525. 1550. 1570.
That's enough. No more. Hold everything.
1580. 1590. 1600. 1605. 1610. 1620. 1630. 1640.
They had done it. It was 3:30 in the afternoon of December 2nd, 1942. A self-perpetuating chain reaction had taken place. Professor Wigner surprised Fermi and brought forth a bottle of Italian wine he had been hoarding. And a group of tired but excited scientists drank a silent toast to the atomic age out of paper cups. Compton swallowed his quickly, went to his private office and called Dr. Cornett at Harvard to report Fermi's success. Of course, this would have to be a guarded conversation.
Hello, Dr. Cornett. This is Compton in Chicago.
Yes, Arthur. How are things?
Jim, I wish to report that the Italian navigator has arrived in the New World and found the continent much smaller than he thought it was.
Excellent. And I hope the natives received him kindly?
Jim, they couldn't have been more friendly.
You are listening to The Quick and the Dead, a biography of the atom bomb.
This is Bob Hope again. Some of you may wonder what the purpose of these four broadcasts is. You and I, ladies and gentlemen, may never see a cyclotron or do an equation, but we've got to know a little something about what goes on under the hood of the atom. As David Lilienthal once said, there is a growing tendency in some quarters that atomic energy is none of the people's business. If schemers or fools or rascals ever get this thing out of the people's hands, it may then be too late to find out what it's all about. Old man Hope is willing to try to learn what it's all about. How about you?
In tonight's program, as Helen Hayes played the part of Lisa Meitner, Paul Lucas was Dr. Einstein. Many members of the Atomic Project played themselves. Some were impersonated. All were recorded. Written and directed by Fred Friendly under the supervision of William F. Brooks. Next week, Bob Hope and the Atom Bomb. This is NBC.